The Amazon is home to some of the last bands of indigenous people not integrated into modern life. But it's long been a place of plunder by those who would exploit it.
Over the course of the last five centuries, the Amazon has become sort of a trading post for things like, you know, indigenous goods and agriculture, to a trading post for industrial goods, timber, mining, and illicit drugs produced on an enormous scale. Much of that trading, much of that economic activity happening on the backs and at the cost of the livelihood of the well-being of the people who live there, and particularly indigenous groups who are caught in the middle.
That's Chris Feliciano Arnold. We spend the hour talking with him about his book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rianna. The Amazon forest is often called the lungs of the planet, covering an area of over 2 million square miles. It plays a critical part in our planet's ability to absorb carbon from the atmosphere. It's also home to more than half the world's species of plants and animals. So cutting down the forest is not only a danger to the people and animals of that region, but it endangers the very system that supports life on Earth. But as Chris Feliciano Arnold demonstrates in his book, The Third Bank of the River, despite attempts in recent decades to protect the forest and its peoples, the threats to the Amazon aren't going away. Illegal logging, gold mining, and the international drug trade continue to make inroads. And now, with the recent election of Jair Bolsonaro as Brazil's president, the threat has only increased. Grounded in rigorous first-hand reporting and in-depth research, Chris Arnold's book is a portrait of Brazil and the Amazon that is complex, bloody, and often tragic. Chris Feliciano Arnold has written essays and journalism for The Atlantic, Harper's, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many more venues. His fiction has been published in The Kenyon Review, Ecotone, and other magazines. He teaches writing in the MFA programs at the University of San Francisco and Ashland University. The Third Bank of the River was published by Picador USA in June of 2018. Well, Chris Feliciano Arnold, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. The Third Bank of the River, why that title?
Well, the title, The Third Bank of the River, actually comes from one of my favorite Brazilian short stories by João Guimarães Rosa called A Terceira Margem do Rio. And it's just this fantastic and fantastical story about life and death set on the banks of a mythical river in Brazil. And it's a story that I've always gravitated toward, and it's just a fantastic and mystical title that I thought I would borrow, and that captures some of how I feel about the Amazon and its mysteries.
Yes, and you were born in Brazil.
I was. I was born in Brazil in the early 1980s, right at the twilight of the military dictatorship there, and actually adopted to the United States as an infant. And so I actually spent much of my childhood daydreaming about Brazil, wondering about what it was like, but it wasn't until I was an adult that I actually returned to Brazil for the first time. And on that first trip, among other places, visited the Amazon rainforest, and that was, among all the places that I saw in Brazil, really the part of the country that captured my imagination the most.
And why was that?
I think in part because it's a place that is so ingrained, I think, in just the popular imagination. I had so many preconceived notions of what the rainforest was all about, and yet when I arrived there and saw for the first time, it in so many ways overwhelmed like any of the preconceived notions I had about it in terms of its sheer enormity, in terms of just the way that the rainforest can really challenge your sense of time and scale on this planet. And at the same time, the warmth of the people and the complexity of the culture there just completely defied any expectations that I had, and it was a place that I was just enchanted by, and found myself over the subsequent years, as I returned to Brazil, visiting several parts of the country, always going back to the Amazon. And it was during the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, when I saw that the Amazon would be hosting World Cup games in Manaus, I thought that was just a really great opportunity to get to understand the region more and understand how it's changed.
Yeah, you arrived in Manaus. Tell us about Manaus.
Yeah, so Manaus is the capital of Amazonas State, which is the largest Brazilian state in the Amazon rainforest region. And Manaus was originally founded on the banks of the Rio Negro and the Rio Solimões as a trading hub during the rubber boom. And over the course of subsequent decades of wealth created by the rubber boom, just really became this decadent city in the tropics. And, of course, as the rubber boom turned to bust, the city also experienced its own economic upheavals. But that cycle of boom and bust has really been the cycle that's defined Manaus over the course of its existence. And now, 150 years later, it's a city of 2 million people on the banks of the Amazon River that remains a city of boom and bust and a city of enormous economic disparity, in which in some neighborhoods you have people leading like very affluent middle class, upper middle class, and wealthy lives, and yet within a mile of those same neighborhoods, you can have tens of thousands of people living without the basic necessities of electricity, running water, access to healthcare, access to education, and so forth. And so it's that economic disparity in of a city that is in some ways so modern, yet that's nested in one of the most remote corners of the world, that really attracted me to the city as sort of a example of just so many trends and so many disparities that we're seeing worldwide amplified there on the banks of the Amazon.
Right. And as you said, you arrived there when the World Cup was happening. There was also a kind of, was it a drought or is it just a normal thing that the river was so low?
Yeah, well, so the river, the Amazon is constantly going through ebbs and flows of its normal hydrologic cycle. But during the 21st century, actually several times in the 21st century, the Amazon as a whole has experienced three once-in-a-century droughts. And so at the time that I was visiting Manaus in 2014 and 2015, the Amazon generally, but specifically that area of the Amazon, was experiencing just a profound heat wave. And one of the consequences of that is it just an enormous spread of wildfires in the region. And so, again, it added sort of another eerie ambiance to the region, and also one that people, I don't think, expect. When we think of the rainforest, I think for the most part people think of like lush, tropical, verdant forest. And yet one of the biggest challenges in the region right now is just the rampant spread of wildfires. And so, again, it was just for me, those fires, that heat wave was just, again, another symbol to me of just how much the region has changed and how much it can subvert our expectations.
And those wildfires, are they due to climate change or are they actually set by, you know, some may be set by some illegal loggers, is that right?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So wildfire, I mean, typically wildfires do not occur naturally in the rainforest. Lightning strikes without rain are extremely rare. And so most fire in the Amazon takes place as the result of slash and burn agriculture or other human-caused fires, as you mentioned, like fires related to logging sites. The way that this is exacerbated by climate change, though, is that as the sea temperature changes have grown warmer, as sea surface temperatures have grown warmer, the entire region of the Amazon has seen its rainfall patterns change. And so fires that would typically be extinguished by rainfall are now being left to burn and smolder for months at a time. Mm. And those fires typically take place at the edge of the rainforest where the human development and the human-started fires take place. So what we're seeing is this enormous rainforest being devoured slowly, inch by inch each year along the edges, by these slow-moving understory fires that actually have a hugely detrimental impact on the long-term health of the forest.
Wow, that's distressing.
It is distressing. And one of the things that compounds that problem is that when we think about these huge wildfires we see in the American West, for example, each time there's a burn that goes through, those fires eliminate fuel and actually make the risk of subsequent year fires less. And so fires, as distressing as they can be in the American West, are actually ultimately, for the long-term ecosystem, generally a good thing. In the Amazon, though, so much of the forest is protected by this thick, rich, upper-story canopy that shields the lower forest from sunlight. And so when those initial waves of fires come through and can take down those larger trees, suddenly that forest floor that's very dense but also very delicate can be exposed to sunlight for the first time in thousands of years and dry out that forest floor and actually create more fuel. So when we see the mega fires in the American West that actually kind of burn up fuel for subsequent years, in the Amazon, those understory fires actually have the opposite effect, and the more the forest burns, the more fuel there is for future burns. And so it is just really this vicious negative feedback cycle, exacerbated by human development, exacerbated by climate change, and absolutely a distressing development there in the Amazon.
Yes, and we should note that the Amazon forest is the lungs of the world. It's what creates the oxygen. Not the only thing that creates it, but it's a huge part of what creates the oxygen we breathe.
Yeah, and one of the things, in a typical year, the Amazon rainforest essentially acts as a huge carbon sink for the world, and it absorbs more carbon than it produces. Well, in drought years, the combination of fire and deforestation can have such an effect that the Amazon actually stops serving that role as a carbon sink and actually becomes a net producer of carbon, essentially reversing its typical role for us in terms of climate and carbon regulation. And so this is something that doesn't receive as much attention as, say, the melting ice caps, but is absolutely one of those mega climate concerns that should worry all of us on the planet and that governments should be working together to figure out a way to solve.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Chris Feliciano Arnold about his terrific book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. So you can't talk about the Amazon without talking about the indigenous tribes. You note in the book that the Amazon is home to at least 100 isolated tribes, more than any other region in the world. Tell us a little bit about that situation right now, because I know that there have been some isolated tribes that have been coming out, but actually more have been found. So where are we in that delicate balance between the destruction of the indigenous people and their preservation?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's a really important issue, and one that's come to light more and more in recent years as the encroachment of human development into the rainforest has led developers, roads, loggers, miners, and so forth, deeper and deeper into these remote areas of the forest. When we talk about isolated tribes in the Amazon, I think one of the most important things for people to understand is that oftentimes these tribes are presented in the media as groups that have had no contact with the outside world, when in fact they have typically had contact with the outside world. It's just been terrible and violent contact. And so oftentimes these are groups, many times there have been family units that have been intact and residual from back in the days of the rubber boom, who have experienced at one time or another violent interaction with settlers, with miners, with loggers, with rubber tappers, and who, as a result of that violent interaction, have withdrawn deeper and deeper into the jungle. And so as those roads and loggers and miners penetrate further and further into those remote spaces, oftentimes these tribes have no choice but to withdraw even further. So when we see this footage in the media of outsiders contacting isolated tribes, it's important to recognize that, like, it's not as if we have found people that have been suddenly living in Stone Age conditions, ignorant of the outside world. In fact, they're profoundly aware of the outside world and its dangers. And so I think the delicate balance that both governments and anthropologists and scientists are trying to strike right now is, at what point are those tribes able to continue to advocate for their own survival, continue to rely on their own ingenuity and instinct to survive and hide from the outside world, And at what point is the encroachment of outsiders simply too overwhelming for them to resist, insofar as even minor contact and even benevolent contact can introduce disease agents, such as even the common cold or a common flu, that has the potential to completely wipe out one of these small and vulnerable groups. And so one of the really critical discussions that's happening right now, especially in the realm of applied anthropology, is whether is there a threshold at which the population is so vulnerable that scientists or governments or anthropologists should intervene and try to, at very least, vaccinate these groups against some of these disease agents. But, of course, that even that benevolent intervention leads to a huge slippery slope of to what degree outsiders should get involved. But it was for me, is in researching the book, just an enormously fascinating question, and one that, as you mentioned earlier, that tribes are being discovered and spotted more and more. I mean, as this encroachment goes deeper and deeper in the jungle, this question is only going to becoming more urgent as more of these tribes are uncovered.
Yeah, and you tell us about a really fascinating case. In this case, there were predations by an isolated tribe on another tribe that had been settled and obviously in contact with the outside. They were part of the outside world at this point. So tell us about what happened. It was just a fascinating story.
Yeah, and so this actually took place. One of the most fascinating parts about the incident of the Shapanawa in the state of Acre in the western Amazon is that this entire incident took place during the 2014 FIFA World Cup. So as billions of people around the world had their eyes focused on Manaus and the bright lights and excitement and modernity of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, a few thousand miles away in the far western Amazon on the border of Brazil and Peru, a tiny tribe in a village called Simpatia, and this is, as you mentioned, a settled tribe, a tribe that lives still very far from the outside world, 7 days from the nearest road, but at very least they have contact with the government, they have radio communication with the government. This settled tribe, the Yashininka, found their village raided by an isolated tribe elsewhere near their territory. Now, the Yashininka had experienced these types of raids before. Typically, this tribe would come and perhaps take some metal tools or pots and pans or other curious items. But for the most part, the tribe wasn't too invasive. It was more considered a nuisance. Well, in this case, in the summer of 2014, the isolated tribe kept encroaching in increasingly precarious ways, to the point where the settled tribe, the Yashininka, radioed the government officials, outside officials, for help. And as the situation unfolded, what we found was that the Shapanawa, this isolated tribe, had actually, these people who were invading the village of Simpatia, were the survivors of a terrible massacre in their home village and were actually coming to the Yashininka to seek help. And so the story that I trace in the book, The Third Bank of the River, is the story of a Brazilian doctor, Dr. Douglas Rodriguez from Sao Paulo, who specializes in indigenous medicine, and his team and their visit to those remote jungle borderlands to address the situation and try to treat this isolated tribe, the Shapanawa, for what seemed to be an emerging illness among the tribe, while also, again, trying to strike that delicate balance between respecting their autonomy, yet while also trying to shield them from danger and disease.
Right. Now, there are also other encroachments, ones of a religious nature. I mean, religion has always been, has always kind of opened the pathway for, you know, the predatory activities of commerce. And this is still going on. Talk about the evangelicals. What role are they playing in this whole issue of integrating and not integrating, you know, the indigenous tribes?
Yeah, so I was fascinated as not only in the history of the Amazon, but in the contemporary day of the role of religious missionary work in the rainforest. And you know, as most people know, religious missionaries and zealous religious folks have played an enormous role in the shaping of the entire new world, so to speak, new world. And yet, I was curious to see how some of these interactions that played out in the age of discovery and during the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries to see how they were playing out in present day. And what I found was that even now in the 21st century, there remains a very keen competition in the rainforest for essentially souls and converts among the indigenous groups. And there's actually fierce competition among different religious groups, be they Catholic, Protestant, evangelical, or so forth, to see who can essentially find tribes or regions that have yet to be contacted by the outside world, or that have had their contact with the outside world falter over the intervening years and decades, and try to win them over to their church. And one of the missionary groups that I met on my during my research in Brazil was a group called Hope for Brazil Ministries, which is an evangelical group that does a lot of missionary work throughout Brazil, but particularly in the Amazon. And I was surprised to find myself at once a little bit disturbed by the degree to which they use various forms of coercion to try to wake up the indigenous groups to their word of the Bible. For example, by bringing medical treatment or by bringing treats or candies or other sorts of gifts to the tribes, which in many ways those methods echo some of the earliest methods that the very earliest religious settlers in the new world used to attract and win over the affinity of indigenous groups. And so that for me was a very disturbing echo of previous religious misconduct and atrocities in the Amazon. Yet at the same time, as I got to know these missionaries, I also grew to appreciate some of the ways that they fill gaps in care and in healthcare, particularly among tribes who are receiving very little attention, if any, from the state. And so for me, during my research for the Third Bank of the River, I found myself just fascinated by the complexity of religious involvement in the Amazon. I'm personally a very secular guy, so I'm very primed to be distrustful and disdainful of missionaries trying to go and convert the natives, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I think the work there is much more complex and much more nuanced than I originally expected when I set out to write the book.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Chris Feliciano Arnold about his book, The Third Bank of the River. It's about the 21st century Amazon. I mentioned how the evangelicals typically have opened up the space for others. Maybe this would be a good time to tell us a little bit about that history of, colonialism in the Amazon. And I'm thinking specifically, for example, of the role of rubber, mm-hmm. then, and then what replaced it and what has replaced it now.
So one of the interesting things about the Amazon from the perspective of European settlers when they first arrived was that they falsely believed that this was some sort of New World Eden, that this forest, this jungle, where animal life and fruit and food and water seemed to be so abundant, was somehow going to be this Eden that had just been waiting for them across the ocean. And yet what they quickly discovered is that unless you have the indigenous knowledge to that region and to that ecosystem and that environment, it's actually extremely inhospitable to humans, and particularly human agriculture, in the way that it was traditionally practiced in Europe, for example. And so in those earliest days of settling, European settlers and religious missionaries quickly became very reliant on indigenous labor for everything from agriculture, food production, hunting, and so forth, to even just basic navigation around the forest. And so over subsequent years, colonists, settlers, and religious missionaries in the Amazon essentially created a form of de facto slavery by which, under the guise of converting the natives to become loyal subjects of God and the crown, they essentially encaptured and enslaved indigenous labor to produce everything from sugar to coca to various medicinal herbs and so forth that could be found in the forest. Of course, throughout that process, hundreds of thousands of tribes and entire ethnic groups were also wiped out by disease, let alone massacre, violence, and all the other terrible torments of that the settlers brought to the forest. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why we now have those tribes living in such deep isolation from the outside world today is because over the course of the centuries, tribes found that their only means of survival, their only means to protect their families, was to retreat further and further up the river. Well, one of those indigenous products that became wildly popular was rubber. And rubber originally was just something that the colonists were curious to see, that the indigenous groups would create these bouncy balls for their kids to play with, or they would create rubber-coated clothes that were really waterproof. And so at the beginning, rubber was just a curiosity. And for a short time in the beginning of the 19th century, rubber was something that was exported to Europe to create things, waterproof galoshes and so forth. But once we hit the Industrial Revolution, rubber became just a key ingredient in the Industrial Revolution, everything from gaskets to bicycle tires to automobile tires and so forth. And so in a short period, in the later half of the 19th century, Manaus rocketed from being just this sort of riverside backwater in the middle of the Amazon to being one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world, on the backs of the Brazilian Amazon essentially being the sole provider of rubber material for the entire planet. And so that's sort of what initially gave the Amazon region its economic boost through a colonial lens. And in subsequent decades, the sort of raw materials that have been extracted from the Amazon have shifted to become more things like, for example, Brazilian hardwood, illicit Brazilian hardwood, which is used in high-end luxury construction projects around the world. Anytime you see yourself standing on like a large waterproof, like industrial-grade deck somewhere, perhaps at a university or at a theme park, there's a good chance you're standing on Amazonian hardwood.
And it's illegal, you say.
So a lot of the timber that comes from the Amazon is illegal, either straight out illegal and has been trafficked, or in some cases it has been laundered. So it has actually been extracted from the forest illegally, but through various methods has been laundered so as to seem to be coming from legitimate sources. And a lot of that timber does indeed end up in the United States and elsewhere. In addition, gold mining has been a huge source of new development and exploration and exploitation in the Amazon. And these are the sorts of raw materials that miners, loggers, and so forth are pursuing in the region. And in addition, probably one of the most enormous and dangerous markets in the Amazon these days is the market for illicit drugs, particularly cocaine coming from Peru, Colombia, and elsewhere through the Amazon region, which has particularly that tri-border region between Peru, Colombia, and Brazil has become one of the busiest and most lucrative and most dangerous routes for cocaine traffic in the entire world. And so what we have now is, over the course of the last five centuries, the Amazon has become sort of a trading post for things like, you know, indigenous goods and agriculture, to a trading post for industrial goods, timber, mining, and illicit drugs produced on an enormous scale. Much of that trading, much of that economic activity happening on the backs and at the cost of the livelihood of the well-being of the people who live there, and particularly indigenous groups who are caught in the middle.
Wow. Chris Feliciano Arnold. We'll continue our conversation with him about his book, The Third Bank of the River, after the break. That was Manaus by Alex Pertu on the album Otra Vez. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with journalist Chris Feliciano Arnold about his book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. It's a sweeping investigation of crime and corruption in the region and how that's impacting the lives of the people there. We spoke with Arnold before the election of Jair Bolsonaro as president of Brazil. But as you'll hear a little bit later, we called him up on the day we produced this episode to get a post-election update. You also speak a lot in this book about not just drug trafficking, but the prisons, which, you know, are filled with drug traffickers, mm-hmm. and from which the drug trafficking is in many ways directed from right within the prisons. So tell us about the prison in Manaus, the prisons in Manaus, the private prisons, and they are a place where the cartels are quite active.
Absolutely. And I will start out by saying that the issue of mass incarceration in Brazil is a national, very much a national issue. But what really sets the issue apart in the Amazon region is this presence of private prison operators. So nationwide, about 3% of Brazilian prisons are privately operated. In the Amazon rainforest, 40% of the prisons are privately operated. And those prisons are being built at a rapid clip and rapidly being overcrowded, essentially as a result of the drug war being waged there in the Amazon against cocaine traffickers and so forth. And so we have a situation where oftentimes prisons that are built for 700 or 800 inmates are housing twice that. And these inmates are oftentimes people who are not, they haven't even faced trial yet. Oftentimes somebody who's arrested even for, say, a petty drug offense in Manaus can spend up to a year in prison just waiting for a trial. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, those prisons are also the hub of major organizing and social activity for the drug trafficking organizations that control that region, in particular in Manaus, the Familia do Norte, which is the family of the North, and which is essentially the crime group that controls that critical drug trafficking area between Colombia, Peru, and Brazil. So one of the consequences of this sort of mismanagement of mass incarceration there in the Amazon is that oftentimes young men, and the inmates are overwhelmingly young men of color, go into the prison for some petty offense and come out a year later even more deeply ingrained in the criminal organization than they were when they began. And so part of the danger of this overcrowding and the mismanagement there in the prisons is that oftentimes the drug trafficking organizers and bosses who are housed there have essentially carte blanche to enact violence and put out orders to kill both within and outside the prison walls. And so one of the incidents that I cover in the Third Bank of the River took place in the summer of 2015, the year after the World Cup, in a weekend that would notoriously become known as the Bloody Weekend, in which a drug trafficker was beheaded in one of the prisons outside the city on the same afternoon as an off-duty police officer was shot and killed outside of a bank in the city of Manaus. And what unfolded over the next 3 days were dozens of drive-by shootings and murders that took place, and the violence became so amped up that it was difficult for anyone to determine who was responsible. Was it the drug gangs? Was it the police? Was it vigilante police operating in retaliation for the killings of one of their fallen comrades? And that swirl of violence is, for me, just really emblematic of so many of the issues at play in Manaus and across Brazil. What I trace is the investigation of who is responsible for those killings.
Yeah, could you say more about that? What are those different strands that are swirling together?
So one of them is essentially that throughout Brazil, but particularly in the Amazon, there is a culture of vigilantism and impunity among law enforcement officers. And so in Brazil, where the courts are so slow, where justice is often served slowly, if at all, oftentimes police, when they find that one of their fellow police officers has been killed, will simply take matters into their own hands. In this case, in Manaus, a group called the Ghost Riders, a group of vigilante off-duty police officers, took it upon themselves to go out and avenge the death of their fallen comrade, but along the way also essentially took it upon themselves to clean the streets of other people who they considered undesirable. Meanwhile, there are not just one, but several competing drug gangs competing for traffic in the area. And so the Familia do Norte was also competing against and trying its best to eliminate off the streets a competing drug gang from Sao Paulo. And so what you have is a situation in which groups both affiliated with drug organizations and groups affiliated with the police, both on duty and off, are essentially in open combat in the streets of Manaus, and principally in the poorest neighborhoods of Manaus, with a lot of innocent victims caught in the middle.
You followed one of those innocent victims, or we don't know if he's innocent because it was difficult for you to find him, but it was a tragic case of a young man, a dancer, who was killed.
Yeah. For me, one of the most interesting parts about the story that as I began my research was that there's so much information about the drug gangs and so much information about the corrupt police and the killers that I really wanted to seek out and tell the story of one of the victims, and the victims who so often remain anonymous and who so seldom have their stories told. And yet one of the tragic things that I discovered over the course of my reporting and research was one of the reasons why those victim stories remain untold is because people, their family, their survivors are absolutely terrified to speak of their death for fear of reprisal and retaliation from either the gangs or the police. And so this particular young man, who, as you mentioned, was a dancer, was a father, a man in his early 30s, who was simply enjoying a cold beer after a dance recital one night and was targeted by a group of off-duty police officers. And I spent several months trying to work with his family, work with his survivors to try to understand more about him and about his story. And I think probably the most important thing I discovered is just the overwhelming sense of fear among the survivors in those neighborhoods, of feeling like there's really nobody that they can trust to keep them safe.
Now, I want to ask you, these prisons, you said 40% of the prisons in Manaus are private. Is it the private nature of them that encourages more corruption, or is corruption rife no matter where you go, whether they're federal prisons or private prisons?
Yeah, so corruption is going to be rife no matter where you go. However, one of the things that makes the private prison situation so precarious is simply the fact that these private operators are so keen to save money on things like surveillance and capacity and so forth. And so in the case of Manaus, for example, when you look at the sorts of shortcuts that private prison operators make, it tends to be around the things like ample security, ample resources in terms of being able to provide health and food and services to the inmates. And there's also a lot of corruption in terms of how these contracts with private prison operators are set up to begin with. So a lot of very shady dealings in the construction of these prisons, in their ongoing oversight, and so forth. And so I would say that there are problems in all of the prisons, but that the private prison operators just allow for even less oversight than you would have in the normal prisons. And one thing that it's really important for me to communicate whenever I talk about whether it's mass incarceration, environmental degradation, or any of the other issues that I write about in the book, is that none of these issues are unique to Brazil or the Amazon or South America. And one thing that's become abundantly clear to me over the course of the several years that I've been writing this book, particularly the last couple years, is that all of these issues are Pan-American issues. And so I don't want any readers to come away from this book with a sense that these are problems that are unique to Brazil or South America, but rather all of these issues are ones that we're very much grappling with here in the United States, whether it's mass incarceration or police violence in our own system, whether it's the destruction of what should be preserved lands, whether it's corruption at the highest levels of government. All of these issues are very much alive and well with us in the United States, even if we put perhaps a slightly higher gloss on them. But for me, the further I got into the corruption and catastrophe in the Amazon, the more I realized how much these issues resonate just as much with us here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we're really talking about is a system of predatory capitalism, which, you know, destroys everything in its path. And one of the things that I'm becoming more and more aware of, it's not just that we have the same problem over here that they have over there, but that, in fact, the criminal enterprises that you talk about are actually global, and they are tied to corruption at all levels of government and business.
Absolutely.
And, right. And I'd like you to talk about that in terms of the crisis in Brazil. I mean, Lula is in jail, unable to run again. Dilma Rousseff was overthrown in a kind of coup d'etat. They were accused of corruption by people whose corruption seems to be even quite more vast than theirs. So tell us about these connections between the criminal underworld and the criminal overworld.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right to call out these connections here between these issues and the ongoing political crisis throughout Brazil. And one of the things that we know throughout the investigations that have taken place in the last couple of years in Brazil is that these connections, as you mentioned, between the criminal underworld and the criminal overworld are very real and oftentimes brazen. So even in the last year, we've seen indications that members of some of the Brazilian politicians who are under investigation have had ties to criminal organizations. And this takes place at the highest levels of government. In the book, for example, I mention an investigation of the governor of the state of Amazonas, who is accused of not only striking deals with drug leaders in prison in hopes that those drug leaders would steer the neighborhoods under their control to vote for him, but also threatening to withhold police protection from entire neighborhoods if they didn't cooperate, if they didn't come around to vote his direction. In addition, we talked earlier about evangelicals. The church leaders are very much involved in this same conversation because those church leaders, much like the drug bosses, can steer the vote of entire neighborhoods. And so we have situations where we've seen evangelical church leaders working in cahoots with criminal organizations and shady politicians in order to, say, provide computers or provide technology for the classrooms at their church. And so you have a lot of people working in their own self-interest against the interests of people that they're supposed to be serving, and this overlap between government officials, criminal organizations, and religious power. I will say, though, that to your point about these concerns being global, earlier this month was reported in the New York Times that over the last year, the Trump administration has engaged in conversation multiple times with high-level Venezuelan military rebel officers who have deep ties with drug trafficking organizations in Venezuela and throughout South America, with the intent of potentially working with these officers to overthrow the current Maduro regime in Venezuela. Now, those conversations didn't ultimately result in a military coup that we know of so far, but I only mention that point to illustrate that these overlaps between the criminal enterprises and government enterprises truly do have global reach, and even our own government administration is in contact with people who have those connections with the criminal underworld.
Oh, somehow I'm not so shocked as I might have been.
It's hard to be shocked by anything these days, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. Now, tell us a little bit about Lula and Dilma Rousseff. You know, Dilma wasn't ever really tied to corruption, but she was, guilt by association.
Guilt by association, yeah.
And Lula seemed to be fairly small potatoes, but on the other hand, maybe I'm being naive.
So I don't think you're being naive. I think, you know, Lula was not, Lula nor anyone else in probably any political system worldwide is completely clean. However, even Lula himself was not directly implicated to the similar sorts of like enormous crimes and financial malfeasance that some others in the Lava Jato investigation were accused of. However, essentially, in the case of Lula, for me, the fundamental question of Lula's legacy is whether the downside of his crimes outweighs the enormous good that he did to elevate millions of Brazilians from poverty to a rising middle class. Yeah. And I don't think, if there were further revelations about Lula, whether presently his jail time rests on the notion that he received a beachside apartment illicitly, essentially received it as a form of a bribe. I would not be surprised if we found that there were more incidences of Lula or his family receiving gifts. But at the same time, when you weigh those gifts against the enormous benefits that Lula ensured for Brazilians of all backgrounds, I think time will tell what Lula's legacy is, but I do think that even if you look across the Brazilian political spectrum, literally dozens of high-level, national-level leaders are accused of all kinds of crimes, ranging from the actual violent crimes to financial crimes to everything in between. And I do think that history will look back on Lula's crimes as being insignificant relative to the overwhelming good that he did for Brazil's people. And although I think that right now, in this moment, things look grim for Lula, I think that for him to be imprisoned while so many other Brazilian leaders are allowed to remain in power, that for me is a disservice to the Brazilian people and a miscarriage of democracy in Brazil.
The corruption of the Brazilian elites that you've spoken about threatens the Amazon. Chris Arnold, you talk in your book, The Third Bank of the River, about some of the forces that are organizing to protect the forest and its peoples. Tell us about them. Is there any hope that they can succeed?
That's a question that really resonated with me as I reached the end of the book, is there any hope? When you look at a situation in which the forest seems to be in greater danger than ever before, when indigenous groups seem to be in greater danger than ever before, and land defenders and indigenous advocates are being murdered with impunity, is there any hope? And this is a question I actually asked of Fiona Watson of Survival International in one of my last interviews for the book, as we were discussing isolated tribes. And what she said that encouraged me was that as hopeless and as grim as it looks now, 20 or 30 years ago, it was worse. So as bad as things are now, we do have indigenous groups organizing for political representation at the local, state, and federal level. We have indigenous groups like the Guardians rallying around to try to defend their territory against the encroachment of outsiders. If we can continue to work to get voices from the region out there and tell stories from the region, that we can get to a point where the spotlight is back on the Amazon. And as we know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And the more that we can tell stories from the region, expose injustice in the region, the better chance we have of rooting out corruption and returning the sovereignty of the region to the people who live there.
That was our interview with Chris Feliciano Arnold about his book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon, which we recorded this summer. We called Arnold up today as we produce this episode to ask him for an update about the situation in Brazil after the election of the extreme right-wing politician Jair Bolsonaro and how it would impact the Amazon region. He told us, as bad as things were before, they've only gotten worse. So, Chris Arnold, we spoke to you before Bolsonaro's win in the Brazilian election. Former president and Workers' Party candidate Lula wasn't allowed to run in the election. Polls showed that if Lula had been able to run, he would have won. So why didn't his replacement on the Workers' Party ticket, who he endorsed, win?
Well, that's a great question, and I think one of the challenges for the Workers' Party in this election was that Lula really clung to the possibility of a candidacy well into September. And so even after he was originally arrested and imprisoned back in April of this year, and even after he was forbidden from having access to the press and ostensibly forbidden from running, he continued essentially to try to organize his Workers' Party campaign from behind bars, working through surrogates to get his message out there. As we've seen, that's a really difficult way to run a campaign. And there was also a bit of resistance and even resentment among Workers' Party supporters, who many of whom felt that Lula was essentially clinging to himself as the leader and clinging to power and not really willing to hand the reins over to another candidate. So in that regard, it wasn't until early September that Lula officially transferred his candidacy and encouraged his supporters to back up his replacement candidate, Fernando Haddad, former mayor of Sao Paulo, former minister of education, who diligently campaigned and hustled across the country, but really from a very disadvantageous position. He had a lot of ground to cover. He had not only in terms of getting his name out there, but just in terms of covering actual geographic ground in Brazil. In the meantime, while he was trying to play catch-up, Bolsonaro was benefiting from an overwhelming wave of media attention after he was stabbed at a campaign rally early in September. So for the Workers' Party, it was really a perfect storm in a context where they were already working from a disadvantage. And Lula's reluctance to transfer his candidacy to a substitute, I think, made the situation even worse.
Well, that's certainly tragic. So now, I mean, aside from the fact that Bolsonaro got a lot of press, why did a man who some people have said is worse than Duterte in the Philippines, a man who, you know, certainly within the living memory of many Brazilians who suffered under the military dictatorship, always supported it, and he's even talked about bringing it back. Why did he win?
That's also a great question, one that I tried to figure out myself in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, for about a week last month. And I spoke with literally dozens of voters in Brazil's sixth largest city over the course of the week. And I was frankly stunned not only at the level of support for Bolsonaro, but also his support across racial and socioeconomic groups. I asked numerous people essentially what they thought of some of Bolsonaro's more plainly fascist statements, his racist statements, his homophobic statements, his statements against indigenous groups. I mean, his comments have run the gamut in terms of people and places and traditions he's offended. And yet, almost invariably, the Bolsonaro supporters who I spoke to were essentially quite willing to overlook those statements as those of just sort of a brash talking former military man, and essentially willing to see through those statements to his message of one of economic change, his promises to try to stimulate the economy, his tough stance against crime, his advocacy for tougher policing. And a lot of people essentially told me that they were willing to essentially hold their noses and vote for the guy. Now, on the other side, there were literally tens of millions of Brazilians who were plainly fed up and disgusted with the guy. Many people who I spoke to not only were Workers' Party supporters who were against Bolsonaro, but were also people who just planned to cast a blank vote or annul their vote and essentially vote for no candidate. And one thing that I think is important for listeners to know is that even though Bolsonaro won the election by some 10 points, 30 million Brazilians did not vote for either candidate. And this is in a country where voting is compulsory. And so even though Bolsonaro did walk away with the majority of people who cast a vote for a candidate, 30 million Brazilians voted for neither candidate, which I think is a strong indicator of just how fed up Brazilians are with the entire political system at this point, and does not paint a very rosy picture for the future of Brazilian democracy when 30 million Brazilians felt that they had no candidate in the race who represented them or their interests.
Well, it's truly tragic. You know, this is a man who said he would give carte blanche for the police to kill, carte blanche for the police to kill, and that he would kill drug traffickers. When we spoke last, we talked about the drug trade that was in the private prisons. There are almost incubators for the drug trade. Does that mean he's going to go after the corruption in the prisons as well?
Well, I think that, for me, I think he's had a lot of tough talk against organized crime, against the drug traffickers, and especially in Brazil's most marginalized neighborhoods. And to your point, those are probably where his statements have been most plainly fascist in terms of his willingness to give police carte blanche to use lethal force and essentially shoot first and ask questions later. Now, one thing that he did try to do in the days leading up to the second round of the election is try to, you know, moderate his statements somewhat, not just on crime, but across all of his different positions, just plainly in a way to try to court centrist voters. But essentially, one of the most dangerous things about Bolsonaro's to-be presidency is that in order for him to drastically change policing in Brazil and make the country a much more dangerous place, he doesn't necessarily have to pass legislation. It's enough. His shift in rhetoric and his willingness to embolden the military police and embolden vigilantes and militias in the country to take a tough stance on crime, just that shift in rhetoric is enough to change the climate and make things much more perilous there in Brazil. And not only that, but many state and local leaders are now following Bolsonaro's lead and, for example, saying that they will be sure to pay for the best lawyers for any police who are accused of shooting suspects. So even without a passive legislation, even without Bolsonaro assuming office, there's already been a very major change in the tone and tenor of the public security conversation there. And it does not bode well for a country that already has an enormous homicide rate and just enormous security problems across the board.
What are the implications for the rights of indigenous peoples, for the constitutional right for some of their lands to be preserved, and for the health of the Amazon forest?
Yeah, so that's a very worrisome question. And to be clear, the rights of indigenous people and the health of the Amazon forest were already in a precarious situation under the 13 years of Workers' Party rule. But the situation there has now gone from bad to worse. Bolsonaro has essentially likened indigenous reservations to chicken pox on the map of the Amazon. He has repeatedly said that if it were up to him, there would be not a single square inch left for indigenous reserves in the Amazon. And in his view, which is a view very traditional of the militaristic leaders of Brazil, indigenous reserves are essentially standing in the way of Brazil's efforts to develop its economy and modernize. And the people who live on indigenous reservations essentially ought to get on with incorporating with the rest of society. So of all of the many problems that Brazil faces in the months and years to come under a Bolsonaro administration, the health of indigenous communities and the health of the Amazon are among the most grave. And unfortunately, the trajectory there is towards one of development and destruction, and that's going to have consequences for everyone on the planet who likes clean water, fresh air, and human rights.
Well, Chris Feliciano Arnold, thanks so much for giving us this follow-up to talk about the election of Bolsonaro, which we're adding to our earlier interview with you about your book, your wonderful book, The Third Bank of the River.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.